The next case on the court's docket is Party Homes of Nevada, Inc., et al. Versus the 8th Judicial District Court, Real Party in Interest, Coyote Springs Investment, LLC, et al., case number 65664. Ms. Lundvall, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, my name is Pat Lundvall for the record from McDonald Corona Wilson. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Party Homes of Nevada. What I'd like to do is to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. The resolution of this writ turns upon the plain language of NRCP Rule 16.1A2D. That particular rule now contains two paragraphs, and since there is no further subset to those paragraphs, I'm going to refer to them as paragraph 1 and paragraph 2 during my argument. Paragraph 1 concerns the disclosure obligations of specially retained or experts or of employees who regularly provide expert testimony. But it is paragraph 2 that is at issue under this writ. The one that's before the court for interpretation concerns the disclosure obligations of hybrid fact witnesses who may possess special background, special expertise, or special credentials by which they may present opinion testimony to the jury. In this particular case, we've got four employees that have been designated pursuant to paragraph 2 as these hybrid fact witnesses that have background and special expertise. Combined, those four employees have over 120 years of experience in the home building and the development industry. They possess the background and the credentials by which to opine upon home building and development in the home building industry. They also possess the credentials by which to define and identify what is commercially reasonable within the development in the home building community. We disclose these four party employees in compliance with paragraph number 2. The plain language of paragraph number 2 does not obligate us to give a report, particularly a report that discloses or identifies all of the facts or the information considered by those paragraph 2 witnesses informing their opinions. And it's that considered disclosure obligation that provides the foundation for waiver of the attorney-client privilege. It's commonly accepted that, in fact, that all information provided to an expert witness pursuant to a paragraph 1 expert witness must identify all of the facts and the information that they have considered. And therefore, if you provide attorney-client privilege materials to a paragraph 1 witness, then those materials may be considered to be have read and reviewed and therefore considered by that paragraph 1 witness.
Let me pause you there for a moment. Prior to the amendment of Rule 16 and the creation of paragraph 1 and paragraph 2 in your nomenclature, if you had designated these four witnesses as expert witnesses, would that have been a waiver of the attorney-client privilege to the extent you plan to rely on their testimony in an expert fashion at trial?
No.
And then tell me why not.
Because if you take a look at what the language was prior to our 2012 amendment, the paragraph 1, the only paragraph then that existed, only pertained to specially retained experts.
What about the normal Rule 49 waiver statute? That's the intersection here that's giving me trouble, which is 49.385, waiver of privilege by voluntary disclosure, which can be by consent or voluntary disclosure, express or implied. And wouldn't you think that if you're designating a corporate employee as an expert witness and that employee has been in the middle of attorney-client privileges on the subject of his expert testimony, that that's an implied consent by revealing what he's going to say, and then it creates the need for that information, not exactly the same, but similar to the Sands case.
Yeah, but respectfully, though, on this, you've got to take a look at what the origin of the waiver, where it comes from. The origin of the waiver comes from the considered obligation. And if you take a look all the way back to the 1993 amendments to the federal court, where this was made express, and where the advisory committee notes were also expressed, is that what this means is that you are waiving attorney-client privilege for materials furnished to an expert. Why? Because you now have to disclose all facts and information considered. But that requirement only applied to paragraph 1 witnesses, only to specially retained experts or employees who regularly gave expert testimony. The 4 employees that we disclosed were pursuant to subparagraph 4.
So your argument is that the subparagraph 2 language effectively says we have an exception here for party experts who've been privy to attorney-client privileges, and that Rule 49 waiver rule I just talked to you about doesn't apply?
Correct. What I'm saying is this. Under paragraph 1, it is express what it is that you know that you have to tender. That it is expressed by saying that you must disclose the facts and the information that the specially retained expert considered. When you go to paragraph number 2, there's no such disclosure obligation.
Well, but the history suggests that the point of that was you don't want to put the burden of preparing a report on plaintiffs who, for example, are relying on treating physicians to explain what they did, but also give their expert opinion because the two are sort of inextricably intertwined. So I'm not sure that the 1 versus 2 is so much addressing a conscious waiver of privilege as it is who has to give a report and who doesn't, and then 2 is simply making clear that you do have to disclose a non-specially retained report expert, and you have to give a little bit of information about him, but it's not as extensive as the paragraph 1.
But you have to take a look at what the contents of the report were. And it's the contents of the report in the express language from paragraph 4 that gives notice to counsel that if you have a specially retained expert, if you have an employee who regularly gives expert testimony, they must give a report and they must identify the facts and information they considered. And so that puts counsel on notice. That gives me an indication, a suggestion, that if I'm designating them pursuant to paragraph number 1, that I am waiving the attorney-client privilege for the information furnished to those particular experts. But when I go to the disclosure obligations for paragraph number 2, there's no indication whatsoever. There's no suggestion. There's no notice. Counsel gets blindsided, like we got blindsided, with that obligation. Why? Because it was CSI's position that those 2 disclosure obligations collapsed into 1. They urged that position then upon the district court. And the district court accepted that, collapsed the 2 different disclosure obligations into a single 1.
Why isn't it, though, like if you put a 30B6 corporate counsel up, you designate corporate counsel as your 30B6 on particular subjects, that designation affects the waiver of the attorney-client privilege on the subjects that that corporate counsel is going to testify to, even though the rule doesn't say that?
Well, from this perspective, then, what you're doing, then, is you're placing information. And under the factual circumstance of this particular case, we don't have those factual circumstances,
but
nothing even remote.
Your point on that is that the opinions, they came by those opinions long before they ever thought about Pat Mundell.
That's correct. And they came and they expressed those opinions to CSI before the litigation was ever filed. So this isn't something that we're worrying about the affect then of trial counsel trying to feed or furnish information then and to try to hide behind attorney-client privilege. That's not what we're dealing with here, and factually that's not what we're having. Those types of situations have been raised in the federal court system. And in the federal court system then, what the courts have identified then, they've looked at the differences and said, in that circumstance, when you draft an employee or constrict an employee after the litigation has begun and you put them in a position as an expert, then they are specially retained. But the facts and the circumstances of this particular case were lived and breathed by these four employees.
Ms. Lundvall, if I could interrupt you, what you're arguing then is that the pure disclosure, or I should say the simple disclosure of a paragraph 2 witness, doesn't result in the waiver. But you're not arguing, are you, that when I examine that witness, when I take their deposition, and I'm asking them for the facts and information that forms the basis for their opinions, that I can't inquire into areas that might have been the result of an attorney-client communication?
Well, what I'm saying is this.
And in such event, the privilege should be asserted at that time and any waiver tested at that time.
From a factual perspective, I agree with Your Honor. From this perspective, we don't have that situation. These individuals lived and breathed the factual circumstances. Mm-hmm. Their full depositions were taken on those facts and circumstances. Why? Because they were fact witnesses. They are the four principal executives that we have dealt with during the entirety of this litigation, and they are the four executives that dealt with CSI prior to the litigation ever beginning.
But assuming for the moment that there had been a corporate counsel, say, during the time that those facts are developing and there had been a communication between them, and when counsel asks in a deposition, what are you basing your opinions on, and part of that includes a communication received from a counsel, one would then test a paragraph 2 disclosed expert at that point.
And that has already been done in this particular case. They have been tested. Judge Denton allowed a preliminary deposition to be taken to determine what information that they had relied upon then in forming their opinions. And so to that extent then, that has already been established in this case. But the one thing that I want to point out, and I know that my time is limited for my opening remarks, but I want to point this out. Specially retained experts are different than your hybrid fact witnesses. Specially retained experts, they learn facts by what counsel provided them. And therefore, it's understandable why there is the disclosure obligation. These hybrid fact witnesses, they learn by living and breathing the circumstance. And if you take a look historically, all the way back to the 1970s, when the federal rules, upon which that in large part our rules have been patterned, they have always maintained lines of demarcation between the specially retained experts and the hybrid witnesses. And the federal courts have protected the attorney-client privilege and said merely by their designation, they have not waived the attorney-client privilege. And that's the position that we're urging upon the court today. Thank you.
Counsel, as you're approaching, I have a question. It appears in this record as if we have a motion to show cause that has not been responded to and therefore should be granted. Do you wish to address that?
I can address that, Your Honor. A motion for an order to show cause is simply a motion that asks for a response. We looked at that when we saw it. We researched that. There is no, under our reading of the rule, there's no response due from us unless the court asks us for a response from it because it is seeking an order to show cause. We'd be happy to address that if the court wants us to file a response to it, but there has been no order directing us to respond to it.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Todd Bice on behalf of the Real Party in Interest. What we would submit the petitioner is seeking by way of this petition is really is an amendment to the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure. It wants to amend them in a way that's even broader than the amendment that was considered on this subject matter back in 2013 and not adopted by this court. I think the best way to sort of understand the contradiction that is in the petitioner's argument is to examine just employees. They acknowledge, petitioner acknowledges, that if it's an employee who is regularly involved in giving expert testimony, that employee has to prepare a report, and according to them, even they acknowledge that any attorney-client communications or work product information that the employee considered in forming their opinions and preparing to give testimony is a waiver of the privilege. But what they now contend is that the exact same employee can give the exact same testimony, can give the exact same opinions, can rely upon the exact same information in giving those opinions. But because they're not regularly employed in giving expert testimony, they don't have to prepare a report. And so thereby, that exact same information that would be available to the opposing side and subject that witness to cross-examination is now off-limits.
So then
that's their position.
I don't hear that, Mr. Weiss.
I believe that is exactly
that's why I asked the question of Ms. Lundvall. The question I posed is, does the disclosure under paragraph 2 by itself waive? The answer is, as I understood her comment, no, it does not. But it does not preclude subsequent investigation upon deposition of potential attorney-client privilege-protected information.
Well, that's not the position they took in front of the district court.
I'm just talking about this writ.
I understand that, Mr. Chief Justice, but that is not the position they took in front of the district court, and it's not the position they took at the depositions. If you look at page 8 of our brief, we point out to you that on the specific questions of what are your opinions that you're going to tell the jury, don't answer that work product. That is what happened in front of the district
court. If this court were to answer the question in this writ, that paragraph 2, disclosed witnesses, does not result in a waiver, how does that prevent you from testing that issue in the district court if someone asserts privilege during the course of the deposition?
Well, it doesn't preclude you from examining that in terms of the deposition, but again, that's not the position, and the depositions of these witnesses have already been taken. And that's the position that the petitioner took in front of the district court. And again, the record is clear on that. They instructed the witnesses not to answer anything on this subject matter on the basis of privilege. And contrary to the claims, these witnesses did not develop their opinions purely as a matter of everything that they had learned prior to the litigation. And that, again, is detailed in the record and then was in front of the district court. They acknowledged at their depositions that, in fact, they were aware of these communications and that the entirety of their experience in this project, including with those communications, were the basis for their opinions. And that's, again, Mr. Rizzi, that's at page 1980 of the record. For Mr. Andrews, it's at page 2012 of the record. For Mr. Giordano, it's at page 2031 of the record. And for Mr. Lash, it's at page 2048 of the record. Those are from their deposition transcripts where they acknowledge these things.
Mr. President, I'm going to back you up for a second. You said that the distinction, if I heard you correctly, the distinction between paragraph 1 and paragraph 2, as we are now distinguishing between those designations, is really... You're suggesting that there's no difference. If these folks are going to be providing certain types of testimony, that there's no difference between what they should be providing to you.
No, I just said that's not what I meant. What I mean is, what's being conflated here by the petitioner is the distinction between what is must be mandatorily disclosed up front, whether in a formal report or in a summary, and what is then subject to discovery. The petitioner, as I understand their position, is taking the position that those the limit of disclosure somehow functions as a limit on, as a restraint on discovery.
But doesn't that happen because of the two different classes of witnesses that we're talking about, i.e. paragraph 1 and paragraph 2?
No, because I would submit that the reason for the differences are just simply, what are you required to affirmatively disclose without the opposing side asking you a single question? What the reason for paragraph 2 being added was you had this category of witnesses that were providing some form of expert testimony, and if they had to prepare a full report, it was cost prohibitive in some cases, and that's discussed at the time of the amendment.
And wasn't the record there? It was primarily to address treating physicians in PI cases.
Correct, treating physicians in PI cases. That's right. And to avoid the burden and the expense of having prepared this comprehensive report, there's a provision that allows them to do a summary. Think about the position that the petitioner is advancing. If those paragraphs, breaking them into 1 and 2, which they're not technically, but breaking them apart like that, if those paragraphs constitute a limitation on discovery, And for the second category of witnesses, they only have to provide a summary of the facts and of the opinion. So is the argument then that you're limited to discovery is limited to just the summary of facts and the summary of the opinion and not everything that went into that and that they analyze and consider and examine? That's the position that the petitioner would seem to be advancing.
That's not the way I'm hearing it or reading it, but that's not for me to determine because that's what we're all here to decide. But having said that, I guess my concern is the simple question, as Justice Hardesty said. Do you believe that a designation under the paragraph 2 as a paragraph 2 witness somehow automatically, magically, waives attorney-client privilege?
I think it puts at issue anything that these witnesses considered.
You're not answering my question. Does that designation automatically waive attorney-client privilege?
Not automatically. If, in fact, attorney-client privilege, and that's why the district court's order is the way it is phrased, if it's information that constitutes a basis for their opinion, then yes, because they chose to designate them as experts. Let's remember, this is a conscious choice by the party designating someone as an expert. They want to put them up in front of the finder of fact and place the badge of expert on them to bolster the credibility of this witness. That's a conscious choice that they are making. Executives testify all the time and can provide opinions about matters. Lay opinions are allowed under NRS 50.265. It's when you want to designate them as experts and you want to use that label affirmatively to bolster your own witnesses in the presence of the jury or the finder of fact, there is a consequence to doing that. And that consequence is you have now put at issue anything that forms the basis for their opinions. And that's why I do think that this case should be resolved largely on the standard of review. It is true that it is de novo review as to the proper interpretation of the rule, but the district court's application of that rule, based upon its review of the depositions and its review and its knowledge of this case and the positions taken by the petitioner in this case, should be reviewed for abuse of discretion. And the record does not show an abuse of discretion by the district court here concluding that these witnesses should be required to disclose those matters upon which, because they want to appear in front of the jury with the expert label, they should be required to disclose the matters that go into, that bear upon that testimony. And whether it's privileged or not, the petitioner put it at issue with the designation. The petitioner can't, again, as I said, Justice Sata, think about the petitioner's position. Simply because the employee, you could have the identical employee. If that employee is regularly engaged as an expert, they have to do a full report. And according to even petitioner, they admit that's a waiver. But the exact same employee could give the exact same opinions, rely upon the exact same information, rely upon and provide the exact same opinions in the presence of the jury. But by the mere fact that they don't regularly engage in expert testimony, they don't have to do a full report. And so they're ipso facto, according to the petitioner, all that information is now privileged and you can't have it, even though you would have that exact same information to be able to cross-examine that exact same witness, if that witness was regularly engaged in providing expert testimony. I would submit, and their sole explanation for this anomaly is, it's the difference between having to do a full report and do a summary. That cannot, I would submit, be the basis for decision. It's because they are conflating what you have to do with by way of an affirmative disclosure for witnesses regularly engaged in providing expert testimony, as opposed to the summary fashion, which this court has allowed, simply as a cost-saving mechanism relative to those that are not so regularly engaged. And if that's the case, the right to broader discovery should be more appropriate for the second category of witnesses because you don't get as much information from them.
So, Mr. Weiss, I assume then that you would agree with the district court's statement here. Thus, CSI's effort to obtain things just because they might be in such a vague and broad category, whether they affect the opinion or analysis or not, is overbroad. However, CSI is entitled to obtain things that were actually reviewed or thought about, quote, considered, close quote, by the disclosed, non-retained, non-reporting expert?
We are, that is the district court's order, as I recall, almost verbatim. I think you were reading from it.
I am.
And we are not, well, first of all, we cannot challenge that order at this point in time, but nonetheless, that's, they are the party
for
challenging
purposes
that order.
Of if this court decides to entertain the writ and were to propose a disposition of this case, mm-hmm. interpreting this language, would you agree that the district court's approach here as to what you can investigate as a result of the disclosure of a non-reporting witness or a paragraph, so-called paragraph 2 expert, is limited to, as the district court characterized it, matters actually reviewed or thought about or considered by the disclosed, non-retained, non-reporting expert?
The answer, the explicit answer to your question is no. The district court's approach to this is more narrow than even what the federal courts have allowed under what the petitioner is characterizing as paragraph 1. Mm-hmm. The standard that the district court imposed upon us on this is more narrow than even the federal courts had long recognized was applicable under the 1993 version of the rules, the very same version that we have as part of what they are characterizing as paragraph number 1. So I do not think that if this court were going to make an announcement as to the permissible scope, that it should be so confined, because the district court's ruling is quite narrow in our view in that regard. So if the court were going to go beyond that issue, I would say no. We believe that the appropriate standard is that which was articulated by numerous federal courts, including the Ninth Circuit, based upon the 1993 version of the rules, the very same version that this court adopted, and the very same standard we submit that the court had adopted.
I pose that question because it appears that both sides have taken extreme views of this paragraph 2 disclosed witness. You seek every potential matter that might have been disclosed to the expert, much broader, as the district court characterized it, than just those that were actually reviewed. And Ms. Lundvall says all of these subjects are foreclosed based on her objections and her commentary in the depositions.
I don't agree, Your Honor, that our request was quite as broad as characterized by the district court, but I understand that the district court is the judge and decides those matters. From our perspective,
that's how the judge viewed it.
That is how he phrases it in the order. From our perspective, we think that we were well within the scope of the federal court rulings regarding the 1993 version of the rules, not just things that they had reviewed, not just things that they had so-called. The district court here gave a narrower definition of the word considered than the Ninth Circuit or other district federal courts had applied it, because the federal courts had looked at this word considered as meaning also things that you knew about, but you ignored, because that can be just as valuable as in showing that you are in fact not trying to provide expert opinion. You are an advocate. You are functioning as a partisan because you're ignoring bad facts, or you disregarded bad facts. I see that my time is up. I thank the court for its time.
Yes, Justice Pickering.
In terms of the record in this case, the judge entered his ruling and then a writ was run. Has there been any in-camera review of the documents that would be allowed pursuant to his order?
To my knowledge, no. I do not.
So we don't have the fine parsing that you might get from that?
We do not.
Okay.
That, I do not believe, ever occurred, nor was it.
It wasn't suggested, as I see
it. Suggested or proffered. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Bice is correct that process has not occurred. But what has occurred is a position that they've taken, and it occurred during the context then of the depositions. They asked for the contents of all the communications that I had with these witnesses, regardless of any of the interpretation that had been given by the court. Their position was in the district court, is in the briefs before this court, and at various different places in Mr. Bice's presentation to you, it is that mere designation waives the attorney-client privilege.
But do you think if you de-designated these witnesses that you'd still be in a waiver position?
No, I don't believe I would be in a waiver position. But the question then becomes is whether or not that we are being confined then by the testimony that we might be permitted to provide at the time of trial. And therefore, you're depriving then the jury of informed testimony then on these particular issues that really aren't even that controversial, that water is important to development of any project.
Right, but to the extent those opinions may have been vetted with counsel, if they were a regular expert, you would be able to get that information for cross-exam.
Well, and see, and that's the point that I want to go back to, because this is a point that CSI entirely glosses over. What is the origin of the waiver? Where does the waiver come from? From 1993 forward, and set forth within the advisory committee notes to the federal rules amendments that we followed then. It says for specially retained experts, there is a waiver of materials furnished to those witnesses. But the line of cases, though, that are in the federal circuit that deal with the hybrid fact witness that may possess special knowledge and special expertise. And we cited six of them to the court, say in that circumstance, with that hybrid fact witness, there is no waiver of the attorney-client privilege. Why? They're not specially retained. Why? They didn't have to prepare a report that contained the considered obligation. That's the key to this.
Ms. Lundvall, under your interpretation of the so-called paragraph 2 disclosed witness, would a treating physician disclosed by an attorney in a personal injury case be required to answer questions on deposition of information supplied to that treating physician by trial counsel?
In that particular circumstance, there is no attorney-client privilege. That's the difference in that factual circumstance with your treating physicians and the employees that we have here. The plaintiff's attorney, typically, that is in having the treating physician provide testimony. There is no attorney-client privilege in that relationship, and therefore the communications were not protected in the first place. In our circumstances, the communications were protected, and there's never been any challenge that has been made either to the documents that we placed on our privilege log, and nor has there been any challenge made to our designation of these witnesses under paragraph 2 of the rule. So there's never been any challenge that somehow that we drafted these people and fed them information in order to provide opinions at the time of trial. To the exact contrary, the factual predicate in this case is that these four employees formed their own opinions and gave them to counsel because they were there before the case ever was filed, before the case ever began.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lundvall. Any questions by the members of the court? Okay, thank you. We understand your position, and we appreciate the briefing and your arguments today. The matter will stand submitted.